Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan. We've talked a little about 2020 on the show, but this week, Alyssa Mastromonaco joins me live in studio to finally address the Bernie Sanders in the room. Then Alyssa sticks around and joins Kieran Deal and brand new member of the Hysteria crew, Naomi Ekperigin, to discuss money. Who has it, who doesn't, and why it's so awkward to talk about it. And of course, the hills will die on. A little housekeeping before we get to the show. Just a reminder, if you are a listener who wants to submit a hill you will die on, you can send them in a 30-second voice memo to hysteria@crooked.com. You can also email us if you just want to get in touch and talk about something. I check the email, and Caroline checks the email, and I'm not sure who else checks the email, but your email will be read. And also, our Nancy shirts are back in stock, so you can go to crooked.com if you want to get one of yours with Pelosi on it. Now let's get to it. Well, listeners, we have a very special treat this week, and I am delighted to welcome Alyssa Mastromonaco to the studio live and in the flesh.
Never leaving.
Please stay here forever. It's so much better when you're here and I can look at you.
I said I'm going to make out with you the whole time. No one can stop me.
Fine. I consent. We're going to cover the news, and then Alyssa's going to stick around for the rest of the show. So first, I want to get into a couple of kind of quick items before we dive into the Bernie thing. Yeah.
Still feeling the burn?
Still feeling the burn or not? Or are we feeling
burned? Or do we
burned?
Need a cream for the burn?
Are we feeling burned? Does it continue to... Yeah. Is it a good burn or
a bad burn?
Okay. A couple of news items, though, that we have our eye on. A 24-year-old Honduran woman went into labor and delivered a stillborn baby while in ICE custody recently. She was 6 months pregnant when she was apprehended near Hidalgo, Texas on February 18th. But ICE released a statement about the woman giving birth to the stillborn baby and doesn't count the stillbirth as an in-custody death, which I find interesting considering how much they've tried to interfere with abortion.
The opposite of what they said on the Senate floor the other day.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Lots of mental gymnastics going on in the pro-life crowd and the ICE community there. So we're keeping an eye on that. All right, next, a quick palate cleanser that I think we can only describe as bite-sized justice. It's the sort of thing that you can hear it within 30 seconds and you get pretty much the gist of the story. And at the end of it, you're like, yep, justice was served. So you remember, Alyssa, that newspaper in Alabama that ran the editorial that was like, bring the Klan back. It was good.
Bring it back.
Yeah, that was what the...
Terrifying.
Yeah, pretty bad. Well, the editor of the newspaper and the author of that op-ed stepped down the other week. And
Don't you hope they were fired?
Yeah, they stepped down amid the firestorm before they got fired.
Allegedly.
Yes, allegedly. But bad news for that deposed editor. The new editor of the paper is a black woman.
Wah, wah.
Yeah. So Alicia R. Dexter will take the Democrat reporter over in Linden, Alabama. And we at Hysteria congratulate her and wish her...
Get it, girl.
Wish her the best of luck. Okay. I would like to talk about both of those things, but we don't have time because we have to finally address the whole Bernie thing. The whole Bernie thing. So here are my feelings about Bernie Sanders. I feel like every single time I talk about him, no matter who I'm talking about him with, I have to preface it by holding my hands up and saying, like, look, I'm not this and this and this, but I'm also not this and this and this. I think you and I, Alyssa, are similarly people who can understand both strong emotional reactions to Bernie.
Definitely. I mean, let me just take everyone on my Bernie journey, which is that Bernie offered me my first ever position in politics in 1995 in Burlington, Vermont, where I was an intern. And as the person who, one, treated me as a human being and engaged me politically when I was like 20, you know, I hold him in high regard. And I liked his policies then, which are roughly his policies now. So, you know, you can critique Bernie for a lot of things, but there are only certain things I will listen to critique on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the other side of the critique of Bernie is the excitement around Bernie. He just declared his candidacy last week, I believe, and he's already raised $10 million.
10 milzos.
Same, and I think it's the same way that he raised it in 2016, which was small donors.
Small donors, but also something crazy I read that something like 30% of the donors were new.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating. You know, I know a lot of people who were not super politically engaged who really got switched on to politics when Bernie started kind of rising in prominence in 2015, 2016.
I mean, like rabid. Like people who I worked with, not in the White House, but in other places, who were really disillusioned, were wearing Bernie t-shirts to work. And
right.
So you can't discount whatever that is that got people involved in the process, because mm-hmm. being involved in the process is important.
Exactly. And there's this huge amount of excitement and enthusiasm around him. And it's impossible to argue that Bernie hasn't moved the needle and moved the conversation, because now the conversation that 2020 Democratic candidates are having are basically things that he was talking about for the last few decades.
You Correct.
Know, the rest of the party has come around to him, and that's to his credit. He's got a ton of excitement. He's raising a ton of money. He's switching people on who are felt alienated from the process. And yet, there was a negative emotional reaction among some people to him announcing his candidacy. And I kind of want to borrow a freshman seminar word. I kind of want to unpack that.
Let's unpack it.
Why do you think, Alyssa, that people...
I have to go first?
Yes. I'm the host. I ask the questions. This is my Bill O'Reilly moment.
You fuck it. Go for it, Chris Wallace.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wallace is a good journalist.
He's a little more, you know, modulated.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But why do you feel like there's still some residual anger and negativity around Bernie as he's redeclaring his candidacy?
So I've thought about this a lot, because the bitterness in the primary isn't so different than it was in 2008 between the Obama people and the Clinton people, right? You had the people who were going to set themselves on fire if she didn't win, and you had people who would set themselves on fire if he didn't win. But when you think about it, the difference is that she became our Secretary of State. So there was some sort of like reunification. People were like, okay, like she's not president, but she got this. The Bernie-Hillary rift never mended,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Do you think it would have if she would have won? Do you think she would have given him an important appointment?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the right thing to do. I actually wish that she would have made him vice president, because I think that would have really... Well, we would have won, probably.
Mm-hmm. Bernie would have won asterisk as VP.
As VP. Don't tweet at me. But I just think that there are, you know, look, Bernie had some problems. There were the Bernie bros who, you know, were not necessarily like on the team after she became the nominee. And people want to attribute her loss to them not getting on the program. And so I just think that there's a lot of, you know, in an election that was so complicated, for a very long time, the easiest thing would be that it was like his fault that she didn't win, and now we have the Russians. And I just, it's really, I mean, I really can't unpack it. It's very complicated.
It is really complicated. And I think coming from a family that was mixed, Hillary and Bernie.
Mine too.
Yeah, we had an awkward Christmas in 2015 where people were like, it was the first time that politics were ever weird in my family.
Yes.
It's like, are we to the left? Are we center left or are we far left? Oh, I don't know. We're going to get in like awkward family debates about that.
I was getting texts from my mom about how Bernie was doing in the primaries, which was unusual.
I'm not sure who voted which way in my family, but I kind of, because people tried to kind of keep it polite. And I think that one of my parents voted one way and the other one voted the other way. And I think that's the first time that's ever happened.
Whoa.
Which is really interesting.
Well, at least no one voted for Trump.
I mean, they better not have. They're kicked
no
out.
No protest vote.
They get to go live with Paul Ryan, Uncle Paul down in Janesville. They don't get to live up in Frederick anymore. But here's something that I thought about. Like, I think that there was bad faith. I mean, if we're talking about assessing candidates and the negative feelings around both candidates based on who aligned themselves with those candidates.
Right.
I think that there were bad faith assumptions made, I hate saying this, but on both sides. Like, the Bernie bro thing isn't a total myth. Like,
no.
There are definitely kind of men informed by their sexism who believe that their liberalism inoculates them from misogyny, which is
right.
not true.
Which, and I think that Bernie did try to disavow that, mm-hmm. you know, platform.
Right. But at the same time, you don't get to choose your fans or your supporters.
Right.
Like, David Foster Wallace was a brilliant writer. His fanboys are the very worst.
Right,
and
right,
they,
right,
and they
right.
They're so bad that they almost make me not like, they make me like his writing less. But, you know, and Bernie had great policies and he had people that were supporting him who were not people he would probably choose to represent him publicly.
Right, right.
And I think the same thing goes for Hillary, because I think that when it comes to the first major party, presidential nominee, I think that there was a lot of historical, anger and hurt. Like, when you're a woman, I think that you go your whole life getting the, death by a thousand paper cuts, little sexisms all the time. And when you're finally in a position where you think you're getting what you think...
What you've worked for.
Yes. And then it seems like maybe you're getting you're facing sexism again, even still. I think that it's easy to really react negatively to that.
Yes.
And to see... being treated differently because of who you are makes you feel a little crazy. And I'm not saying that Hillary people are crazy, but it makes you feel that some people are doing that to you all the time.
Because here's I think I can sum up the feeling. If you are those people, those women, enough. What else does she have to do to be able to win the fucking election?
Right. And
enough.
And to be fair, when Hillary, after the 2016 election, people were like, Hillary, please go away. Please go away. Please go away. And now, and if she were to declare her candidacy, people would be just apoplectic.
They would have had the same reaction roughly that people had to Bernie.
Yes. But I feel like because Hillary was at the top of a losing ticket, I feel like it would be even more so. Bernie didn't get a chance to run against Donald Trump, but there's still a negative reaction to it because it's just like people are like, look, there's sexism in the way that people have treated Hillary and Bernie, no matter how you shake it.
Correct.
Bernie didn't choose to have that happen.
Right.
Neither did Hillary, but that's reality. And so people are reacting to, I think, the perceived attitudes instead of the actual candidates themselves and their policies, and the fact that Bernie has for decades been standing up for women, for minorities, for workers.
Right.
All of that goes away when his most ardent and vocal supporters, or when anybody's most ardent and vocal supporters, are fucking assholes to you.
Assholes.
You feel like they're being assholes to you. So it is difficult to unpack. I mean, what are your personal feelings about Bernie running?
What's wrong with you?
I'm sorry.
Here's my thing. So here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to say that I think that the electorate has told us some things in the past 100 years. One, going for it a second time, usually not that successful. Two, most people who become the Democratic nominee and win the presidency are a little younger. And I think that what the midterms tell us is that people are looking for a new, fresh voice. Mm-hmm. Now, that's complicated because so much of the new, fresh voice that these new entrants to politics have are sort of what Bernie's been talking about for many years. So you can see why he would still be a very relevant player in 2020. But part of me thinks that, we need a new broom sweeps clean kind of vibe, and we should start fresh.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting take. I also think you mentioned the face of politics and the Democratic Party changing. And I think that the face of the party is the same, but our elected officials now just reflect who we are, who is voting for them more closely than it did before. That just reminded me, Chicago had a mayoral runoff last night, and the top two vote getters were both black women.
African-American women.
Chicago will have a black female mayor for the first time in its history. They toppled the Daily. So I think that that's a really good, the Daily, the Daily legacy in Chicago is a huge deal.
Do you know my Daily legacy?
No.
Okay, so when he was chief of staff, Bill Daly, who ran for mayor, when he was chief of staff, he told me that a pair of my pants were so ugly he'd burn them if he owned them.
Well,
they were plaid and they were beautiful.
I believe they were beautiful.
But, I still don't feel good for people losing. So, it's not like I wished it on him. It's not retribution.
Well, I think that that Bill Daly losing in Chicago is a good example. It should be a warning for 2020 Democrats that, Bill Daly might have had good ideas and he might have had good connections and he might have had bad taste in fashion. Because obviously yours is unassailable.
Impeccable. Please.
Perfect.
You should see me today, guys.
Yeah, it's like clogs.
Like chef's clogs. Hanesway leggings,
clogs,
but I pulled it together.
You did it.
Thank you.
You fully did it.
But the one thing about Bernie, though, that I am still so conflicted, well, not conflicted, but I think people need to think long and hard about, in the week that we talked about where he raised over $10 million, he had something like 350,000 donations.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there.
Yep.
And if people discount it, they will be as wrong as they were the last time.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And then just also to kind of double back on what we were saying, I think that if you're looking for a progressive candidate who's championing a lot of things that Bernie is championing and who also brings a freshness and a youth, I feel like there are some candidates in the mm-hmm. field that are, and some of them have been on Pod Save America or yep. are about to be on Pod Save
Maybe
America.
They'll be on Hysteria.
Maybe they'll be on Hysteria. That knock on wood, that'd be great.
Maybe we should ask them all how they feel about Bernie.
That would be, you know what? That is such a minefield of a question. That was super unfair for me to ask you that.
It's okay.
That was like, you know.
I think I really handled it with
you
a plum.
You did a great job. Remember 5 years ago when every magazine profile would ask a female celebrity if they were a feminist and it was just a huge blow up? It was just like a trap. You were never asking men how they felt about
it. No.
But anyway, I'm sorry I sexismed you, Alyssa.
That's okay.
So we unpacked the Bernie thing, kind of.
Deftly.
And we just want all of you to know that if you're a Bernie supporter, if you're somebody who is personally finds Bernie's support not really your cup of tea, we're not on either of your sides.
No, we just think we need to talk about
it. We just think we need to talk about it, and it's healthy to kind of unpack things around the last election, because otherwise we're just going to repeat our mistakes.
And this is the last time we're using unpack for today.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We have to take a break. When we come back, personal political.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello, welcome back to Hysteria. This is Personal Political. I'm Erin Ryan. I am so excited for the topic we're tackling today. It's something we've wanted to talk about for a really long time. We're going to talk about money. What is it?
Why do we need it?
What can it be used to purchase? What is purchasing? And we're going to talk about the awkwardness of money, why we don't learn enough about money, and the way that money interferes with our relationships or enhances our relationships and all that stuff. And we're going to solve it, guys. We're going to solve it. I'm bringing in an all-star team to join me today. First of all, Kieran Deal. She's a filmmaker. She's an actress. She's a writer. And she is going to own a Bentley airplane.
Bentley airplane, guys. It's the duck boat of the sky. Get on board.
Did you just improv that slogan?
I've been thinking about it for a good 18 hours.
You know,
I'm like, what would I buy with money? Bentley airplane. Bentley airplane. People are like, not a house or savings. Nah.
Because you live on the Bentley airplane.
No, I don't live on. Alyssa.
Why not? Bro, I didn't realize you were that posh.
Yeah, no.
Now I know.
I was like, no, that's. That's the purchase. That's the purchase. It's like Bentley airplane, then groceries. You know?
Amazing.
Second up today on the squad is America's soulmate and the author of the forthcoming book. So Here's the Thing, Alyssa Mastromonaco.
You guys, am I like your Sally Field?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, you are.
Right, Gidget, though. Gidget / Flying Nun.
Flying Nun.
Mm-hmm. Flying Nun. Yeah.
Flying Nun in a Bentley airplane.
You fly.
Coming to Netflix.
You are flying as a nun next to my Bentley airplane.
That's really cute. You can hold hands.
Yeah.
Well, you can't get that close to a Bentley airplane.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I was like,
I'll just wave. I'll just wave with my aerodynamic hobbit.
Yeah. Flappy hat.
And last but not least, newest member of the squad and... on her first episode.
Welcome.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. She's a comedian, writer, and co-host of the Couples Therapy podcast, which she co-hosts with her man, which is adorable, I think.
It's tender. It's unhealthy. It's love.
It's Naomi Ekparagon.
Hello. What is money? Where do you get it?
Where do you get it? That's a good question. What does it look like?
How does it
I hear it grows
head?
On trees.
That's interesting. Well, I wanted to get into the money thing just because this is something that Kieran has expressed an interest in talking about. Naomi, you've expressed an interest in talking about it. And Alyssa, you too.
I've written about it.
She's written about it. We've all thought about it. Some of us might even have money on us right now. I think I have like a dollar in my pocket.
Couldn't tell you how much.
I have $20, which I asked my husband for before I left the house because I didn't go to the ATM.
Oh. You were going to say, because I'm a kept woman.
I know. It's like you asked him.
Yeah.
He holds it, and then he doles it out, you know, based on your behavior.
Yeah. Well, there are a few things about money that I think we all kind of wanted to dive into. First of all, women and money is a little bit fraught because in the U.S., at least, we haven't been able to access it in the same way that men have been able to access it for very long. I think it was just in the 60s and 70s that we just were able to get credit cards without our husband's permission, which is crazy.
Because very few people on this podcast are married.
One,
so that means
I'm married.
One out of four.
I got married late in life.
But Naomi is like, Naomi's like super betrothed. She's like extremely betrothed.
But I keep the money.
Yeah, that's
how I keep my independence.
But the first thing I want to talk about is like money education. That's something that Kieran, you've brought up a lot. How much, Kieran, do you feel like you know about money and finances?
Considering that I opened on wanting a Bentley airplane.
Yes, tell us about that path.
Yeah, the path to the Bentley airplane. Yeah, I would say I think it's a big topic that causes like a lot of shame. Like, I think about, like, in health class, right? It's like, no matter who your parents are or where they are, like, the sex talk happens in school. Like, that's a thing that happens in school. But, like, there's no equivalent class at any point in your life about money that is required in the American education system. And I think that's criminal.
I totally agree. Especially, I was thinking about this even before, you know, not just how do you spend it? How do you invest it? But even just doing taxes. Mm-hmm. How can you graduate an American high school and not know how to file your own taxes? Mm-hmm. Something that ostensibly everyone is going to have to do at some point in their life. You can't get around it. And they won't even teach you that. And I feel like that is such a basic
skill. Just give
us
a TurboTax tutorial, if anything. Like,
right.
Explain what the fields mean. You know, I will never. In college, my dad started making me file my own taxes. Something that should have taken 30 minutes took 2 days because I was like so nervous to press that button because I didn't know if anything I put down was right.
Right.
Right. I think, Kieran, going back to what you were saying about there not being money education in most schools, I think that brings us to where people learn about money, and that's in their homes and it's from their parents. And I think the fact that we have to learn about it from our parents means that people who have parents who have money end up learning more about money. So they end up kind of ahead of the game when it comes to dealing with their own shit.
But do you think so? Or do you think people who grow up around money grow up with it never really being an issue because they don't have to struggle with how to maintain it?
But I think they learn. They, like, for instance, they're going to have a bank account earlier.
Good point.
Certainly going to have like a savings account.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Maybe even a trust fund. Mm-hmm. Just knowing that exists opens you up to then the basic questions,
making it interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like,
you're engaged and wanting to know how you get more.
Exactly.
And building credit over time. Like, if you're building credit from when you're 12 or 15 or whatever it is, when you get, you know, when you get a credit card, then that's a very different narrative, you know. Or I know people who use their college loans to buy property during, you know, like
that seems wrong.
That's crazy.
Is that a mistake? That sounds like a mistake.
I don't know if that's legal.
And that's the problem.
It wasn't me. I don't own anything except for a future Bentley airplane. But like, if that's not legal, I didn't say who. So sorry, government.
No.
But yeah, I mean, people who most people are very wealthy in this country, it's not about the income that you make. Mm-hmm. It's about a lot of your money is passive income that is accruing more money for you. And that's a very different way to think about work and money. Mm-hmm. It's just like this idea of passive income from money that is nested away somewhere versus like, I'm going to make this wage and spend pieces of this wage, which is, I feel, very much how we are taught to think about work and work equaling value.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times money education, if you're not somebody who was taught when you were a kid, a lot of times your first real lesson is when you get a red envelope in the mail that's like, you are we're going to come to your house. Right. And so you don't understand what credit is. You don't understand what money is until you've destroyed your credit and set yourself back financially for a really long time. Like, I went to college at, I went to a private school. I went to Notre Dame, and I before I had gone there, I hadn't been around rich people at all.
Same.
It didn't occur to me that they that were that many of them. I just thought there
They've
was
multiplied.
Like, yeah, right. It was just like, well, you know, the chiropractor in my town has a big house and an in-ground pool, and that's the rich guy.
So our rich guy was the equine veterinarian.
Oh, really? We had a rich veterinarian, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, specialty.
Yep.
Yeah. Horses.
But, you know, I went to college, and it was the first time that I was around people who could just, like, buy an airplane ticket.
You know, like, right. Or who got Pathfinders for their birthday.
Yeah.
That happened. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, going to college, I remember the first time I met somebody whose parents were paying their $50,000 a year tuition just out of pocket.
Right.
Just out of pocket. And I remember graduating from college, and then those people were able to use everything that they earned to save for themselves.
Have an apartment without four roommates.
Right. And they didn't have, like, their credit wasn't completely dependent on their ability to pay student loans off. And then they were able to buy property in their 20s. And then, you know, now they're in their 30s, and they've traded up, and I'm still paying my student loans off.
Yeah. I mean, I went to school. I started rich school in middle school, so I definitely knew 11-year-olds with credit cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were in New York.
Fuck. Yes, in New York. I went to school in the Upper East Side, and I learned very quickly, you know, like, you know, I'm from Harlem, but I'm from original Harlem, not the Red Rooster you think of now. Mm-hmm. And so there was definitely...
That was an important clarification.
It is, though, because I feel like people hear Harlem and they go, ooh, and it's like, nah, girl. And there was a dividing line. And to watch Manhattan change and what happened once you hit 96th Street, if you were on the East Side. So it was literally a different world at that time, you know, and what it was to see people have money. And then I also went... I started there in sixth grade, which made the year after that bar and bat mitzvah season.
Whoa.
And so if you want to know who rich, just go to a bar and bat mitzvah. Where is it? What's happening? Mm-hmm. Are there themes?
How many people? What's the entertainment?
I mean, Nick City dancers are coming through, all right? Eli is a man now. And so it would be like, but you would see that, and there was just such a consciousness very early on of, like, having and not having.
Yes.
You know, and being like, oh, how does that happen? But then at the same time, like, before I'd gone to that school, I thought I was fine. Like, my mom's a lawyer. Like, it wasn't rough.
Right.
But it was like, oh, there's, like, a way to be, like, to never think again. And, like, the difference of, like, it was work for her for me to go to that school, even with partial scholarship, right? And as you said, people who were just like, oh, yeah, they just pay for school, and they're set. And then, like, when they get out, and especially if they want to be creative, they get this allowance.
Mm-hmm.
To help them, like, float, you know, their dream.
Right.
Money is comparative. Like, this is a big, like understanding what wealth is comparative. Like, they had this thing called gross domestic happiness. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Oh, yes.
No. Yeah. And it's, like, gross domestic happiness, and, like, Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world, but everybody's poor together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty fucking happy.
Happy.
Do you know what I mean? Because you're not, you know, it's like in India, it's like to be rich means to have a fridge and, a television. Like, it's like, oh, which means that you could be poor in America and you just have those things.
Right.
And that is, like, upper middle class. Like, you are bawling out of control. You understand?
One of my favorite interviews that I've ever seen is a Bob Marley interview where he's being asked, you know, are you wealthy? And he's like, well, you have to define what you mean by wealthy because, you know, no, I don't have planes, but I'm happy. I live here, you know, so I always, like, default to that.
Yeah.
I think at the same time, talking about wealth, talking about whether or not you're wealthy, talking about whether or not you're successful is awkward. It's super awkward. Talking about it with your friends is awkward. Like, have you ever had a conversation with somebody and realized that you were both in totally different, you were both living in totally different worlds?
Yes.
Like, when it comes to money.
Yes.
Yes.
And it wasn't, it's not something that you realize. And I think, you know, specifically Kieran and Naomi, you both work in a creative field. And Naomi, you touched on this, but it's really hard to get started as a writer, as a comedian, as an actor, as anything creative, because you make no money. And a lot of the people that are starting alongside of you are able to do it because they have somebody subsidizing them.
Well, and this is what, I mean, I think it goes to why we're having this conversation, what we're talking about. It's not your fault if you were born a baller. It's your fault if you pretend to be poor and act like we are in the same trench, okay? That's, like, what makes me crazy. I feel like, you know, there is, I think there's shame around not having money, and then there's also the shame around having it. People don't want to talk about, you know, they don't want to admit maybe that they are getting help. And I don't necessarily think you should, you know, brag about it, shout it from the rooftops. But I think it can,
I will.
It can be when you get your Bentley plane.
Graciously.
You won't have to shout it, because we'll just see it at the tarmac.
Right.
It's going
to
be loud.
Gonna hear it. It's going to be loud. I'm going to hear it overhead.
No.
But I'm like, you should, you can talk about that. I also think in talking about it, you then take the, you take the shame and pressure off of the friend who doesn't have.
Yes.
And the person who's wondering what they're doing wrong.
Yes.
Because their life doesn't look like that life.
Well, and you know, for me, so creative fields, yes. Government, not exactly a boon, you know, if you are. But people think because it's a powerful job that you have money.
Yeah.
And they don't know. You know, I mean, I lived in really a not great situations up until, you know, I finally got a proper promotion in the White House. And once I did, the thing that I tried to do, because I was so ashamed all those years, I had no money. I had terrible credit, which we can talk about later. And once I got myself out of that hole, I really felt it was my duty to pay it forward. So I did kind of own that I was in a better financial position, but in a way that people who had problems felt comfortable to come talk to me. Because everybody should know how to fix their credit. And someone came to me, their house was being foreclosed on, and they were so ashamed. And it could have been fixed if they had just asked for help 6 months earlier.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. The idea of pretending that you don't have money is something that you see a lot in politics.
Yeah.
Where it's like you see politicians being like, yeah, I'm just a regular Yale law grad who worked in corporate law for 15 years. And now I'm at a state
with a
fair.
Partner.
Now I'm holding a corn dog just like a poor guy. And you like
holding it like I think it's delicious.
Yeah, I'm holding it, but my pinky's up. But this is how poor people eat, right?
This is
oh my heavens! This is delectable. But I think that like pretending to have had to work harder than you had to work is something that you see in politics and in creative fields. And I also find that a little bit annoying too, as somebody who grew up without really any extra money. It's sort of like, no, dude, don't steal the
don't steal my experience.
The one thing I have is the fact that I had to overcome being lower middle class. That is my that is my one struggle. Like, let me have this.
But class is a big thing, like, because I was born in Britain and my mom always talks about class, you know, because it's massive in England. You know, it's like, it because it's wealth, it's oriented around wealth, but it's also around your name and around your accent. Like, there's all these markers of, like, that say who you are and how you're valuable and why you should know the Queen or whatever the fuck. So it's like,
I met the Queen.
Of course you did.
That's just,
sorry.
Wow.
You got your Bentley. I met the Queen. Keep going. Wow.
I love the way he's like, side note, I met the Queen.
Side note.
Very impressive.
Wealth is all around us.
I'm going to tell you about my shitty credit later. let me have the Queen.
You have the Queen. But, like, class is a thing in America, too. Because it's like, I went to Harvard, and I grew up in Boca Raton. I went to Boca Raton. My parents were first-generation immigrants.
Britain to Boca?
Britain to Boca. My dad was...
I'd watch that.
That's a memoir. That's a lot.
I'd read that. I'd watch that.
Coming to Amazon.
Thank you. Oh, God. Guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This might be the path. We might have found the path. But my grandfather worked in a factory. They were he was a first-generation immigrant from India to England. He was a middle school teacher, became a factory worker, like kind of really like that kind of hustle, worked for Jaguar and like was just a shoe salesman and then like saved all this money. Parents were the first ones to go to college because the government bankrolled that in England at the time. So got a job as an engineer teacher, moved to Florida and picked a school district. They picked a place where the public schools were good. So I actually went to a high school where a friend of mine had a movie theater in his house. Like, it was like, that's what I mean when I say comparatively poor.
Right.
I was not poor.
Right, right.
But they had a house and whatever else. But it was like, I remember going through the second gate to get to his home and somebody was like, do you work here? And I was like, I am going to Harvard. Like, that's the first time I've ever said that in my life. I was like, how dare you? How dare you? But it's a comparative thing.
Right.
And then it was like, but it's also the placement of somebody saying, hey, because this school district is wealthy, let's make sure we fall in these lines or zones so that we can get this education at this good public school.
Right.
And the way that that impacts opportunity then, because now think about the, you went to a good school. It's like the categorical advantage, the gift of education for mobility in our nation.
Definitely.
Is massive.
I also want to talk a little bit about generational wealth, because that's an important thing too. When we look at people who have mobility now, like millennials are out earning their parents by, I think, like, I think 50%.
How?
Right? Yeah.
And who are they?
Who are these millennials? I thought they're all writing for the internet. I think it money.
Well, apparently they figured out how to make that profitable.
Really?
I mean, but
50 bucks a post.
They're out earning their they're out earning their parents, but at the same time, they're not owning property. They're not having children, because everything has gotten so much more expensive that it's like not an economically sound decision to do those things. It's not feasible. And it also, like, reading that stat made me think about generational wealth and how it's kind of accumulated, and how a lot of people who are like the bootstraps crowd don't understand that it wasn't until, like, you know, it was just a generation ago that, like, black people couldn't own property in areas that had high property values, and they couldn't pass that along to their children, and that kind of robbed them of the ability to create legacy wealth. I just want to talk about, like, rich parents. Like, rich parents and how they have impacted your situation, or they've impacted the situations of people around you.
Did anyone have rich parents?
No.
Yeah, no.
No.
But see, you know what? Poor kids try harder.
It's okay.
I'm sad about it. Like, I'm still sad about it. I would have loved to be a person. you know? There's a social component, too. It's like, then you, because you were talking about how you end up getting into debt. If everyone around you takes ski trips and that's how you meet people.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Or everyone around you is on a yacht, or everyone around you grew up sailing or grew up horseback riding and you don't. That is a social marker. That is, again, a class marker that forms bonds that is going to enable you to get jobs and network and, like, do all this shit that matters so that you can have a Bentley airplane.
Well, it's interesting, though, because, like, when you say, like, those things, you know, like, all those activities, I'm like, ew, I wouldn't have wanted to be friends with those people.
Right, of course.
But I went to a liberal arts college, very fancy, a lot of, like, we're going to pretend we're broke, but we actually have money, because I learned that the moment I was like, oh, none of you guys have campus jobs.
Right.
Like, I had the loan, the scholarship, and the job at the library.
Right.
And then if you, like, didn't work, that meant someone was just paying for you to go to college.
Mm.
I remember taking a film class, a film production class. It was my first time. I was a film major. You didn't take it junior year, and I was like one of the only people in that class who had, like, never touched a camera. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And that's the difference too. Like, I remember getting into being like, it's heavy and expensive and I'm scared of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who are like, I know already how to use this. Either I have my own, or I took, like, a film program at NYU last summer or something. And that is, it's like, it's a different way, but those are other sneaky little ways in which you get that leg up, you get
well,
that group.
And for me, it was my first internship in D.C. So when I had my internship in Burlington, Vermont, which was much easier,
With Bernie.
I was a hostess, I babysat, and I had a third job. I can't remember what it was. But when I went to D.C., that wasn't possible because of the structure. So I saved money all year long.
Mm.
And I got my little internship, and I had my three outfits that I rotated. Right? All Free People.
Yeah.
Without blazer. And I had, and I made my lunch every day. And it was the first time, and I didn't think to ask my money. Like, I'd saved the money. I was proud of myself. But it was the first time I really was like, wow, I'm less than these people.
Yeah.
Because they took cabs. You know, I took, like, three metros to get there. I was sweating through my clothes by the time I got to work. And that was my first time where I saw these kids who were being fully funded, who had nice apartments. I was sleeping on someone's couch for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this is coming from where I grew up, where everyone was basically kind of, you thought everyone was roughly the same. That was, like, my first real moment when I was like, I'm not, I like to say different, not less. I for sure felt less.
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up. And I also think a lot about in the, like, creative field, is that people who are of means are overrepresented in those fields because it's impossible almost to get started if you don't have means. So that means that D.C. is populated. The government is run by people who have no idea what it's like to need money or to not be able to take cabs places. Or and I was just thinking, you know, as you were talking, Alyssa, about how much you had to save, I was thinking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and how she's paying all of her staffers a minimum of $52,000 a year, which is an absurdly high starting salary in D.C. And she, I read that she's not using more money to do that. She's just hiring fewer people and paying them like human beings. And I feel like that's maybe the only path to like allowing people with a variety of experiences to actually come up through the government. Because if you don't, you know, if you don't have money, you can't really do that.
And if those first internships aren't paid, you know what I mean? Like, just the, and these are long hours with long, like how many people just don't get the shot is what it comes down to at the end of the day. Like, how do you begin if you don't have?
Well, and part of what, when I was at the White House, that we had a very long discussion of was, you know, for a White House internship, the paragraph about your volunteerism. And I was like, I never would have had time to volunteer. If that was a requirement for any of my internships, I never would have gotten one because I had to babysit.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I had to work
in
a restaurant.
I felt
that it was. It and is. we changed a little bit sort of the requirements because we realized it wasn't fair.
At the average, and then, and you, Alyssa, will know this for sure, but it's like out of the House of Representatives, it's like the mean is $800,000 and the Senate, it's $1.2 million.
For their personal wealth?
Personal wealth.
Yeah, I think that's close.
That makes me so fucking angry.
Of course.
That makes me so angry. That is, those are the median numbers of what the people who represent everyone in this country make. Think, like, just think
or
about.
Have. Or
have.
Have.
Or what they have. But think about how are you the one deciding what people get paid for Social Security, for unemployment?
Minimum wages. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all because,
teacher,
you know,
salaries.
And it's so frustrating because, you know, as much as we don't want to think that, it matters, you know, our personal experiences inform our level of empathy and the lens through which we see the world. No matter how many degrees you have, no matter how many internships you may have had, right, it's still going to come ultimately from what you know and what you recognize, what you relate to.
Right.
And so when you've got 800, if you've got 800 grand, if you never have to worry about that mortgage payment and you never have to worry about your kid getting good enough grades to get the scholarship to go to the good school, your kid could fucking coast on all D's because you can buy their way
but
in.
But also, when you've never had to figure it out for yourself, you don't know how to communicate it to people who need you to help them figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've never had to worry about how to file your taxes or how to refinance your house or anything like that, you don't think about the people who do have to worry about those problems or have any idea how to come up with a program that could help them.
Right.
Yeah, that's that is really a good point, and it just made me black out for a second because I was like, fuck, everybody that's in a position to help me has no idea what I would have needed when I was in my 20s.
Well, no, but here's, you have to have faith that in every room there's one person, right? Like I am not a policy person, but I was always permitted to sit in on policy discussions. And when there was a discussion about food stamps, everyone was having this very sort of, you know, cerebral conversation about it. And I finally just raised my hand and I was like, I like used to work at the grocery store that was the only grocery store for 50 miles that took food stamps. So let me tell you how people are humiliated and embarrassed and how I had to pass judgment on what they were buying and be like, no, we have to put that in a separate pile because that's taxable grocery.
Exactly.
Right. And the things that are considered non-essential, diapers, tampons, maxi pads. Think about that. You're just like a mom trying to buy diapers.
Wait, poor people have like
needs.
Like they're not just like Barbies
bodies.
Down there.
They have bodies.
No,
they have bodies. Periods.
They have periods.
Can you imagine?
They, they can't afford those.
Porn. That's, period.
They should just stop that.
I mean, that I think that's the empathy piece that you brought up, Naomi, is really important. And you know, and it plays out in rooms where nobody knows what they're actually talking about beyond like the theoretical. I want to go around the table and everybody give, like, imagine you can take a time machine back and tell yourself at age 22 one piece of financial advice that you've personally learned. Alyssa, do you want to go first?
I'll go first. So I am someone who had terrible credit and didn't know it for a very long time until she wrecked her car, needed to get a car loan for $5,000 and got denied. So I personally am just totally vigilant about always checking my credit and seeing what my Social Security number is attached to, because good credit will get you very far. And so that is my credit score.
Okay. Naomi?
I feel like I wish if I had known, you know, no matter what it was, no matter how much I was making, I wish I could have told myself to save 10% of my income.
Yes.
Even just 5 or 10%. Because there were definitely times in my 20s where, like, for instance, I was an editor at an art magazine where I was like, every 2 weeks I got paid. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I could have saved some of that, especially given that I wanted to make the transition into the creative stuff.
Yes.
And it wouldn't have been huge, but it would have been enough. Like, maybe I would have moved to LA earlier. Maybe I would have, you know, done certain things as someone who's been engaged for 6 years and still doesn't have money for a wedding.
Mm. You know? I want to double down on that, because the one thing I did create as I got a little older, I mean, once I paid off, you know, my debt and fixed my credit, was my fuck you fund, which was basically 10%. As I got older, I put it in like a deferred savings plan straight from my paycheck, so I never saw it. But basically put enough money away so that if I ever had a job I hated, I could pay my rent for 2 months.
Yes. Mm.
And that was no matter what, it wasn't even in my savings account. It was like my separate savings account.
Ooh, that's
like,
I gotta learn about that. We'll talk about that off mic. Separate savings.
Separate savings.
That's a really good idea. Some people say that you're supposed to have 6 months, but
I mean, 2 was a real achievement,
right?
Yeah, 6 months. What are we, kings? That's crazy. Kieran, how about you?
I think one would be to remember that things don't matter and they don't define your value. I've been joking about the Bentley airplane the whole time, but your value is not defined by how much money you have or what you do. Worth as a human being and the amount in your bank account, those are two separate things. And I think very often in a consumerist culture, we conflate those two things. Mm-hmm. I think it's incredibly important to remember it doesn't matter what the fuck car you drive. Like, it doesn't matter if you're Bradley Cooper, if you're homeless on the street, you have value and worth as a person. And that is very, very separate from wherever you buy wine or mm-hmm. coffee or clothes. Water or clothes, like those are very separate things. And then I wish I'd learned more about things I still don't know, like a Roth IRA,
you got to get one,
like a 401k.
Yeah,
there's all these numbers with letters.
Right,
the number letter money stuff.
Right. Especially as a freelancer, like
yes,
in essence, what we are. I don't know. Like,
but FSA and HSA.
What's so interesting now is that when you hear someone who says they have a 401k, you think they're rich.
Right. I just think, oh, they know what's
they
up.
Know, yeah, yeah, right.
I think they know what's up.
Right.
They know what's up. They've done it, you know, or like how to invest, like just any sort of like money, like beyond like trying to have good credit and like save and like not do stuff and live below your means. It's like, I wish I had like gotten really literate at the tools that that would help you to make passive income.
Yes.
Because that is ultimately how you would build a nest egg for yourself anyway. Mm-hmm. Getting good at that. I mean, I've never really had enough to do something significant, but I remember you said, it's like, if you took those times you were working, you took 5% of that or whatever you could do, $100 a month.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What, or $50 a month or $5, it doesn't matter.
It's right.
But if you've been doing it consistently after 10 years, that's still money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Right, of course.
And if that was making you money, that's like a thing we all need to live. And I wish that was something I learned. It's something I still need to learn.
I
will learn it in the airplane.
I think your airplane is just going to be stocked with financial literacy information.
Yeah. That's part of it.
Bonds.
And iPhones.
Can't go wrong with U.S. government bonds. That's my like 1940s newsreel.
That was very good.
Thank you.
We liked it.
Chicken in every pot.
Thank you.
A lot of voices in this episode. I like that.
Yep. It's a voicey one. That one thing that your point, Kieran, reminded me of was that Anne Helen Peterson piece at BuzzFeed about millennial burnout that went hyper viral, where she kind of characterized a lot of financial stuff as like high effort, low reward activities. They're things that it takes a lot of effort to learn how to set up a portfolio if you don't know anything, and balance a portfolio and manage your finances if you're starting from zero.
You're still using that word. And I keep thinking of like, the portfolio. And I keep thinking of like headshots in a binder.
Yeah.
Binders full of women.
Yeah. Binders full of myself. but it takes a lot of effort to start from zero and learn what all these things are. And like, it's like speaking another language. And the reward is you're somewhat financially solvent. It's not a pleasurable thing. It's just you.
Right.
The reward is stasis.
And it's like a thing for the future.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you don't get to see it for a very long time. And the punishment is kind of a slow burn inability to get the things that you want to get. So it's like really hard to grasp the risk reward of it. So I think that it's something that people just need to decide to set aside a weekend where it's like, look, I am going to make myself some tea, have a nice breakfast, and sit down with this book for 4 hours, like Finance for Dummies or whatever, mm-hmm. and like figure out what the very basics are. And then at the end of this weekend, I'll know more than I did at the beginning. One thing that I wish I would have done when I graduated from college was just stay on top of my student loans and go out to bars and drink half as much because I spent so much. I was in Chicago right after college, and that's a really good place to be just out of college. It's really fun. But I spent so much time in bars that sucked with people I no longer talk to, drinking like shitty beer. And if I would have just taken one weekend night every weekend and done something like gone on a run by the lake or read.
Or you could have just gotten, if you like Jose Cuervo, you'll love Pepe Lopez with Crystal Light before you went out. That's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, I think like I spent too much money on like going out and I didn't pay enough attention to my student loans. And so like late in my 20s, I had like a catastrophic coming to Jesus type moment where I had to like do a loan rehab program. It was like not a bankruptcy thing, but I had to like be totally on top of it and perfect.
You had to get right.
Yeah, I had to get right. And it was so much more effort than it would have required me to just always stay on top of it. It's so much easier to stay ahead of it than it is to catch up to it. And I wish that I would have known that when I was 22.
It's like you're not grateful that you didn't get into a car accident until you're in an accident. And you're like, man, 5 minutes ago, things were so dope. And I like wasn't in this car accident and stuff.
Well, there you have it. Money is like being in a car accident that just keeps happening your entire
every day,
life, over and over and over again. We have to take a break, but when we come back, the hills will die out. All right, we're back with more hysteria. We've reached the end of the episode-ish. I mean, who knows? This could drag on for like an hour. I'm not sure. We're on the hills we'll die on. Let's start with a listener hill, and then we'll all weigh in.
Hi, hysteria. My name is Agatha. I'm calling from London. That's London, England, not London, Ontario. And the hill I would really like to die on is makeup in a gym. We all go to the gym at different times, and sometimes you'll be wearing makeup. That's fine. But please don't put makeup in the changing room before you work out. Why would you do that? It's bad for your skin. It's bad for everything. And even worse, come on, perfume in a changing room before you go work out? That's gross. I hate it. I'll die on that hill. Love you all. Bye.
I support
hard
this.
Agree.
I support this.
That's I'm just so impressed she goes to the gym. Good for you. Yeah. Getting out
I saw
there
a horrible thing in a gym changing room one time. My old work used to pay for us to be members of the Equinox in Soho.
Posh.
In Manhattan.
Posh.
I know. We didn't pay. I wouldn't have paid for that on my own. But one time, it was before work, and I was like drying. I had taken a shower. I'd worked out, taken a shower, was drying my hair, and there was a girl. I was like, "What smells like crotch?" And I turned, and there was a girl who had taken her just worked out in underwear and was holding it over the hand dryer.
Stop. That's
okay. Was,
you know where that doesn't happen? Planet Fitness in Columbia County, New York. Okay.
Somebody would have said something.
It was like
if you see something, say something.
Something.
Domestic terrorism is everywhere.
Everybody saw something. Everybody smelled something. Nobody said anything. We were all too polite. It was horrifying.
Oh, no.
But it's
not,
it's not as offensive. I mean, it's I think it's more offensive than perfume and makeup. I completely stand with our listener on her hill.
Agree.
Yeah.
But this one was, every time people talk about like locker room stories, my brain like snaps back to that moment.
I can feel it.
Can I tell you the freedom of being over 40? I just say hell no to that shit now. I would have been like, now I would be like, girl, stop.
Yeah.
Right.
Wrong.
Right. You are not at home.
Assault. Red light.
Yeah.
Yes, you are not at home.
Assault. Red light.
Assault. Red light. Red light is a great phrase. We should be a red card.
Red card.
Yellow card.
Flag
card.
On that play.
Yeah.
100%.
Just have some in your back pocket to hand out to people. This is a no.
I think we should all get one red card a day and we hand it out and then that person has to just go home and think about what they've done. All right, so I'm going to get to my hill. I was listening to some Bruce Springsteen this week, as one do, and I was listening to Born to Run, and I got to the part in the song with the glissando. You know what a glissando is? It's when you hit one key of a piano and you run your finger down it. And the glissando is sort of the Springsteenian mic drop. Like when it gets to that point in the song, mm-hmm. Bruce is like, "I've made my point, but I'm going to repeat it again." And I just love a glissando in a song. This is a positive hill I'll die on. When a song has a finger going down the piano keys, I just love it. It brings me joy.
That's tender.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that word. Glissando.
You clearly weren't in high school band.
It's. I was.
Well, then you weren't paying attention.
That's probably closer. And then I was like, in my mind, I was like, wait, was I? Wait, I'm not sure. I'm really genuinely not sure. I was in a band at some orchestra. Bougier.
What is, seriously?
But I like glissando. It sounds like the charcuterie.
Yeah.
It's like the charcuterie of the instrument.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, if they hadn't named that piano maneuver after it, it would definitely be like a name of a medication.
I was going to say like lube.
Yes.
Glissando.
The glissando.
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, Naomi, the first ever hill you'll die on this show.
Okay. I'll tell you this. All right. So last night for my lover, co-host Andy Beckerman's birthday, we went to a group dinner. And it was one of these places that there seemed to be a lot of in L.A. where they recommend you share. You get multiple plates and share. Don't you require me to share food with people? You don't know my relationship to them, how close we are if I want to be eating off their plate. You don't know my hunger level, all right? So you have now created this social pressure for me to split a plate's worth of food with someone I barely know. And those small plates are always too expensive for the amount of food.
And too small.
And too small. And they're like, I recommend you get a bunch of items and share. You don't know me.
But also, how about when they judge you, because you don't know how fucking big the plates are, and you're like, well, how many should we order? And they look you up and down and go, two or three per person. Oh, what does that mean?
This woman said last night, this waitress said last night, she goes,
for you?
For you?
For you? For you.
How many Weight Watchers points do you have left, yeah. Alyssa?
Yes. I think you could deal with just one.
The
waitress said, are you guys sure that's a lot of food? Bitch, yeah, I'm sure. I know what I want. I came out to a dinner. And the fact that she said that, I was almost like, you don't know me. Like, it comes back to that. Okay, this is the hill I will die on. You
know
don't
what?
Know me.
That was an excellent hill.
Thank you.
Excellent. Out of the gate hill.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Both elbows
strong,
were on the
table. Strong debut.
There was gesticulating. There was passion.
Livid. Livid.
Hard agree.
I think that's a very good hill, because if I'm just out with my boyfriend, it's pretty, you know, yeah, we share food. But right. If I'm out with a group of people, you don't know the relationship to the other people,
yes.
You're with. Like, you and Andy might share.
Right.
But you might not want to share with, like, you know, Andy's friend's girlfriend, you know?
Then don't go to that restaurant.
And no, I
don't pick
we
that
got
restaurant.
There. That's not what it said until we got there. She was like, we get there, and literally they're like, you know, appetizers, mains, large plates. And then she goes, we get there, and she's like, we recommend you share.
Well,
that ain't what
well,
I signed
that,
up for.
That should be the hill. Be clear.
That you're going to have to share if you come
here. Be clear about the sharing.
No, I just think you don't tell me. Even if it was a tapas restaurant, you don't know me. I may want five small plates to myself. Don't tell me what to do. I'm about to give you money.
Naomi,
don't tell me what to do.
I'm on the opposite side of this for you.
Yeah, that's because your thighs don't touch, Karen. Yeah, you gonna share a damn plate.
No, it's because I like a lot of different kinds of food. It's like I don't
you know
go
what?
To, no, listen,
take
listen.
That Bentley
no,
money. Take that Bentley money and
no,
buy five plates.
You know
no,
what?
I'm not doing that. Because that's why I'm going to dinner with you. You buy a fucking plate, I'll buy a plate, and I'm gonna eat off your plate, whether
Sick.
I know you or I just
Sick.
Met you.
You know what
Sick.
Else?
Like, why are we at dinner if I can't eat off of your plate? What the fuck is wrong
oh,
with
I'm
you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's have a general meeting and then just touch fingers the entire time.
This, Karen, you also, people do not have IBS. I don't want a smorgasbord of food. I want one kind of food going into my stomach so that I can digest properly and not have a, air quotes, situation.
Yeah. Well, I might have a situation, but
okay,
I don't have
self-control.
Okay,
so if we're going to argue on these hills, every damn week, oh. I am coming through hard.
That's exactly how we want you to come. Guys, I'm fucking dying. Like I was almost at the point where, have you ever been laughing so hard that you're like, I'm at the top of a roller coaster hill, and if I fall, then I'll have to get up and leave the room because I won't be able to stop laughing. It'll be like vomiting at this point. That's how I almost felt. Thank you, Naomi. That was beautiful. Yeah. And thank you, Karen, for also disagreeing. We love it when women fight. That's like,
we fight respectfully.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, I was like, fuck you. Respectfully.
Respectfully.
Okay, with all due respect, like, fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah. Respectfully, you're dead to me. Yeah.
Okay, Alyssa.
Respectfully, let's never be on again.
So, here's my hill. We know that Karl Lagerfeld passed away. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Karl Lagerfeld always attacked were clogs and Birkenstocks, even though I think he actually designed some. And so I've always thought that was weird, and I only wear clogs and Birkenstocks. And then I came to LA, and I found it to be the most judgmental clog place I have ever been.
Yeah.
They were like, are those high heel clogs? And I was like, I don't know. They're chef's clogs from Sweden. Oh, they're comfortable. So anyway, my hill, which is not nearly as aggressive or interesting, is that clogs are fucking awesome, and you can't stop me. Ever.
Wow, now it's my turn to disagree. Clogs are a recipe for a turned ankle and weird foot cramps.
These? Look at these. They have rubber bottoms. Okay. They are highly secure.
I don't trust.
There's no heel on that shoe, Alyssa.
Shoes with no backs can fuck off.
I'm scared of shoes with no backs. I'm scared. How do my feet stay in it? Is it because you're not really walking?
They swell to their normal size and they stay in the shoe. That's how it works.
Except it's a slipper.
Instead of wearing shoes where when your foot swells, it looks like your foot's a loaf of bread baking outside the pan. Mm. This just looks like you're normal.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hard disagree. But you know what? Last week, Grace Parra brought in a pair of super high, like wooden circa 90s, like candies looking clogs. And it was offensive.
Mm-hmm. See, those are not the clogs I'm talking about.
Okay.
You're talking about a comfort clog.
I'm talking about dance clog.
You're not talking about like a sexual clog.
Think about the things nurses and chefs wear. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm not sexy, guys. It's okay. You don't have to be.
Sexual clog is the grossest.
I like sexual clog. I wasn't on board with the clog, but if you make I like the idea of a sexual clog. That makes me.
I know
really
what
happy.
I'm. I know what I'm getting to wear on your Bentley plane.
Sexual clog. We've got really detailed plans for this plane. Kieran, what's your hill?
I'm a convert to Costco. That's not a. Is that a hill?
Yeah, you can. That's a bold statement from someone about small plates.
I hated Costco, and then I went home, and my parents were like, Costco, 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 Costco. It was like being indoctrinated into a cult, and Costco, Costco. Oh, you know what? Get this from Costco. Go to Costco. Buy a sports bar from Costco. Do it at Costco. Get gas from Costco. Costco, Costco. My mom would be around the house. I was like, oh, where'd you get that? Costco, Costco. I mean, then my relatives came. And they were all about Costco. And I was like, these people are crazy. And then I got a membership and I went.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't want to be anywhere else.
Yep.
It's the only place I want to go.
Do you eat the snacks?
When they're available. Of course I eat the snacks. Did you hear what I said about the plate? Like, I'll eat anything that's available, especially if it's free. And you know this.
And it's been touched by 100 other people.
I've seen it.
Where did you eat dinner? The place where it was free.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good hill. So we've got small plates. The small plates war will continue, I think. The sharing war will continue.
You guys, next time I'm here, I'm just bringing small plates.
Also, if you go to that happy hour, I'm going to be like all up in your...
Would not allow it. Would eat before.
You literally...
Would eat before knowing that was coming.
The listeners can't see this, but Kieran just made hungry, hungry hippo hands.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have. I'm sorry that we have to end this episode. It was so much fun. Naomi, Alyssa, and Kieran, thank you so much for stopping by. And there will be more Hysteria next week. I am from another planet. This nation is our Janet. But these girls can fan it. 1-2-K email and scan it. Don't take no for an answer. Girl with a mouth that's overdone. Right, 'cause girls just wanna have fun. So Annie, get your gun. Give them what they want.